Lecture 17, Bronze, Terracotta, and Portraiture.
This might not be the sexiest topic ever. We're going to cover industry, manufacturing, and some about the Etruscan economy. But there's also art, religion, the rise of portraiture, and fine jewelry. And if that doesn't get your attention, there's also gods of the underworld and fake silver vases. Not excited yet? You might want to see your doctor about that. The major categories of Etruscan art included tomb paintings, bronze statuary, gold jewelry, and terracotta works, including freestanding sculpture, relief plaques, and decorative vessels. In all of these, we see a number of consistent patterns. First, the Etruscans were, if not originators, then innovators in portraiture. They created a well-developed portrait tradition of images that transcended the generic. They created what has been termed true portraiture, capturing the image as well as the character of the person portrayed. In other words, art that showed what someone looked like as well as what they were like. One of the larger patterns identified in Etruscan art was a close connection to the current subjects, materials, and style trends in Greek art in the city-states of southern Italy and Sicily. Clearly, the Etruscans were aware of the latest styles. They valued Greek art and imported it, as well as invited Greek artists to work in Etruscan communities. In these ways, Greek art profoundly changed Etruscan forms of artistic expression as well. Well, in addition to the arts that were heavily influenced by Greek and Eastern models, the Etruscans developed a number of artistic industries, notably in bronze and terracotta, free from foreign influence, particularly in their early phases, which date back to the Bronze Age. Let's briefly survey the techniques of manufacturing bronze and terracotta, and then discuss some of the works that resulted. First, let me point out that the Etruscans' success in all of these industries was based on the tremendous natural resources found in the Etruscan heartland. In terms of minerals, Etruria is the richest region of subalpine Italy for metal deposits, with rich deposits of copper, iron, lead, silver, zinc, arsenic, mercury, and tin. And it's not just the clay beds and mines. If not for the vast forests that provided the timber for firing clay and smelting metal, their industrial domination would not have been realized. The Etruscans were superb at exploiting these resources, and it's very possible that they divided the territory of their city-states, at least partially, based on mineral resources. The Etruscans were experienced and skilled metalworkers, with a long history of bronze work particularly. The central Etruscan city of Orvieto in modern Umbria, for example, was known for the scale and quality of its bronze workshops. The Romans removed 2,000 bronze statues from Orvieto when they captured it in 264 BC, according to Pliny's Natural History, an almost unbelievable number from just a small city. Well, by the 5th century BC, the reputation of Etruscan metalworking was so high that bronze objects, such as tripods, candelabra, and containers, were desired in the highest status Greek homes. The Etruscans used a full range of sophisticated techniques for working bronze, iron, silver, and gold. The most common technique for creating objects was casting. The Etruscans used both direct casting, that is, pouring molten metal into a mold, and lost wax casting, during which a wax model of the final form is encased in a mold, which is heated to remove the wax so that it can be replaced with molten metal. This latter is the standard technique for the finest ancient bronze sculpture. Etruscan examples are seen in two of the masterpieces of ancient bronze sculpture, the Chimera of Arezzo and Mars of Totti. Often, casting was used to create the sheets of raw material that were shaped using other techniques. For example, much Etruscan armor, including helmets and breastplates, began as cast sheets of bronze that were finished with hammerwork. Raising, that is, hammering a flat disc of metal over a stake to shape it, was the standard means of forming a helmet bowl or the deep hollows of a breastplate or the knees in a pair of greaves. Now, as metal is hammered, it becomes work-hardened. To offset this, the Etruscans used annealing, heating and then cooling the metal very slowly to soften it and make it ductile. Casting and raising were used to create and shape very large objects. For smaller ones, lathing, that is, spinning metal that's then burnished into the shape desired, was preferred. It was commonly used to mass produce small vessels from about 300 BC onward. All of these metalworking methods are still in use today. I had the experience of recently watching a craftsman make mint julep cups by lathing, and with the exception of his electric motor, he was using the same metalworking technology employed by the Etruscans. Well, in addition to these basic forming techniques, casting was also used for vessel feet, handles, and rims by 600 BC, and entire vessels were cast by 400 BC. Rivets and solder connected vessel components and separate elements, such as the feet and handles. A great example of all of these technologies and techniques together is the Ficcaroni cista, a cylindrical metal box of about 2 feet in height, used to hold cosmetics and jewelry, found in a tomb in central Italy. It has a sheet body that was hammered into shape, and then feet and handles that had been cast separately and were riveted onto it. Now, all of these techniques are fairly standard and exploited by each of the major Mediterranean civilizations. What set the Etruscans apart was their use of refined decorative and finishing techniques that were far more advanced than even the Greeks were utilizing during the same periods of time. Decorative techniques were more varied than those used to create the metal, as well as more time-consuming, and required higher levels of expertise. We think that the workshops were organized hierarchically, with the most experienced artists employed in the decorative side of the industry. I think it's useful to briefly, very briefly, I promise you, to run through these to give you a sense of the range of this work. Well, perhaps the least sophisticated of the decorative techniques is what's known as flat chasing. This is done with a hammer and punches to indent the metal while removing none of it from the surface, unlike engraving. Flat chasing creates low-relief designs by driving down the background, leaving the desired figures in a low relief. Final internal details are then chased with sharp tools. Related to this is stamping, which required decorative stamps that were hammered into the surface of the metal, as one would strike a coin with a die to create an image on each side. That contrasts with a more subtle technique of engraving, in which various fine-pointed tools were used to draw designs on the metal. It's essentially a form of carving, and the technique that allowed the artisans to create the most complex scenes, such as those on Etruscan mirrors and the Ficcaroni cista. Repoussé was the commonest form of decoration in classical vessels. The term describes embossed work, which is carried out by hammering a piece from the back. The vessel, to be decorated in this way, is set face downwards on a soft, yielding surface, and work is carried out from the rear with hammered punches. The final details are added by chasing from the front by means of punches to define the outlines of the relief and to inscribe detail. Repoussé was also often accomplished with a carved or molded die, or into a negative die to create the form necessary. Inlaying and overlaying, often with wires of precious metal, were used to provide color and detail. Inlaying was created by laying wire in recesses that were cut or stamped, and then heating the piece to melt and fuse the wire and the body metal. The use of, for example, silver wire in a bronze background created a high contrast and a rich look. Inlay was also created using niello. This is a mixture of copper, silver, and lead that, when inlaid and heated, created a black line or design that would contrast with the metal and increase the visibility of decorative elements. Also, gold leaf and gilding were discovered. Using a metal foil, or by the 4th century BC, the use of a mercury gold solution, which left gold fused to a silver surface. These local industries and techniques were critical in the development of later Etruscan and Roman art, notably the portrait tradition and the promotion of elite male martial identity. Some examples in the key industries of terracotta and bronze give a sense of the development of Etruscan art, specifically in the creation of portraiture. One example is a 5th century BC hand-carved terracotta head of a young man who wears a diadem over his hair which is rendered as a series of wavy locks. Taken as a whole, the head is largely intact and in great condition. The figure's ears are carved in an abstracted pattern rather than a naturalistic representation. The face is composed of regular features, including a slightly open mouth, a long nose, arched eyebrows, and large almond-shaped eyes. Traces of pigment can still be seen in the ears and eyes. The man's features show elements of Greek sculpture of the 6th century BC. This is probably the result of an Etruscan sculptor basing his work on popular Greek examples. Now, this rather generic, certainly idealized figure is a votive. Designed as donations to a sanctuary, votives were placed on display as tangible markers of the piety of the man or woman who dedicated them, as well as the power of the deity who granted whatever prayer they were in thanks for. Votives, in the form of human heads and busts, are commonly found from Etruscan sanctuaries, with terracotta being the most popular material used. This votive head is probably from a southern Etruscan sanctuary, perhaps from Veii, which was besieged and sacked by the Romans in 396 BC. Not all Etruscan bronze sculptures were votives, although the majority that survive, such as the Chimera of Arezzo and the Mars of Todi, certainly were. Many works were probably made for domestic, civic, or funerary use as well. One portrait bust from about 300 BC might have been made for any one of these locations, but since it was donated to the Capitoline Museums in Rome in 1564 and its find spot was unrecorded, it pains me to say that we'll probably never know for certain. The portrait has been long known, for no good reason, as Brutus. Its assumptive identity as the founder of the Roman Republic, who overthrew the last of the Etruscan kings at Rome in 509 BC. That identification is baseless, but the notion that it represents a specific individual is probably accurate. The tight-lipped, middle-aged figure looks ahead in a way that reinforces his dignity, a key quality for men, while not adopting the Greek ideal of youthfulness for his features. In fact, the work has modeling in the flesh of the face that indicates forehead wrinkles, bags under the eyes, and deep grooves that run from the nose to the corners of the mouth. This work shows a severe man. It was probably displayed in a house and later moved to a tomb, much like the painted portraits of ancestors found in Etruscan tombs of the late 4th century BC. It's an example of the Etruscan tradition of portraiture and a statement of personal values of elite males in the local artistic tradition, without explicit Greek influence or imitation. The bust is created using technical expertise and artistic skill, and represents not just a mature man, but also a mature art. A contemporary portrait piece in terracotta provides a great example of the range of portrait sculpture in Etruria. It is a votive head of a woman created in a mold consisting of just over the front half of a head down to the base of the neck. The open mold was filled with a slab of clay that the artist worked into the crevices of the mold to create details. The figure has regular, very classicizing features, including a long nose, small mouth, and wide-set eyes with articulated pupils and two Venus rings on her neck. Her hair is center parted, with long locks that run from the center part to the back of the head under the veil, with the exception of two small side ringlets, which terminate in small hook-shaped curls in front of her ears. She's wearing a diadem and is presented in what is called capite velato. Her head is covered by a veil. Traces of black paint are preserved in her hair and red paint on her face. Now, this figure demonstrates the Etruscan adoption of Greek conventions with its very classicizing forms of facial features and accessories. The remains of the red paint on the face, however, reflect the practice of painted terracotta statuary known from the description of the 6th century BC terracotta cult statue of Jupiter Optimus Maximus on the Capitoline Hill in Rome. Because the face of Jupiter Optimus Maximus was painted red, triumphant Roman generals would paint their faces red in imitation. As a votive, this piece is certainly from a sanctuary. We can trace it to a Latri, a small community in Latium, which becomes part of Roman territory in 306 BC. An Etruscan sanctuary a few miles north of the city was excavated in 1889, and many painted terracottas were discovered there. Well, Etruscan portrait traditions continued to affect Italic and Roman art in the period following the political absorption of the Etruscan city-states as well. An excellent example is the votive portrait bust of a man from the early part of the 1st century, found at the Manganello Temple in Cerveteri. This is a southern Etruscan city about 25 miles northwest of Rome. This terracotta portrait is painted with red skin tone, following Etruscan conventions. It's an image of a middle-aged man with close-cropped hair, slightly prominent ears and nose, forehead wrinkles, and distinct nasolabial folds that run from the corners of his mouth to the corners of his nose. This figure, apparently a portrait of a specific individual, is calm, with a closed, straight mouth displaying maturity and dignity, important virtues for an ancient man. Well, in addition to the remarkable skill in terracotta and base metals, such as iron and bronze, Etruscan artisans excelled at work in precious metals. Their jewelry shows the most advanced metallurgical techniques found in the ancient Mediterranean. I'm not a jeweler, but I've read that some of their work cannot be duplicated even today, notably their granulation work. Now, granulation is a technique in which a surface area of an artwork is covered in granules, or small spheres of precious metal, which are then fused to the background material to create patterns. One of the largest, most impressive, and most important pieces of Etruscan jewelry was discovered in a tomb at Cerveteri. It's a golden fibula, a long pin used to fasten clothing, and it was found at the burial site of a high-status woman whose body was laid out in one chamber of the large Regolini Galassi tomb in about 650 BC. The fibula demonstrates the spread of Eastern influence in art during the Orientalizing period in the advanced, specialized techniques used by the Etruscan jewelers. These include some of the finest granulation ever discovered from antiquity. Filigree, that is ornamental work of fine gold wire formed into delicate tracery, and repoussé, embossed work, which is carried out on the piece by hammering from the back. Corinthian pottery, which was imported into Etruscan communities around 650 BC, definitely served as the source for the major decorative subject of the fibula, five striding lions, an Assyrian motif, surrounded by a filigree vine and rosettes. The size of the fibula or pin, just over a foot in length, and its material, soft, almost pure gold, make clear that it's a symbolic and not a practical work for daily wear, as stunning as that might have been. It might have been created specifically for this burial, to reflect the status of the female deceased, I think in a manner parallel to the shields and chairs for men, each signifying high status according to gender. It's been proposed that the tripartite design of the fibula, which is not unique, reflects the Etruscan view of the structure of the world, with the lion panel representing the upper world, the lower panel the underworld, and the two strips in the middle with their pattern of parallel zigzag lines, the rivers or seas that separate the two. The fibula and Etruscan emphasis on elaborate jewelry also stands as an example of the statement of the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus on the Etruscans that they surpass the other barbarians, non-Greeks, in the extravagance of their way of life. Well, one intriguing element of the terracotta and metalworking industries is the evidence for how and where they intersect. This is seen in the material defined by the term skeuomorphism, meaning, in this case, the manufacture of works in one material designed to evoke the appearance of works made in another. This is most commonly seen in Etruscan vessels where terracotta substitutes for the more expensive metal, either bronze, silver, or gold. The question is often asked, well, as often as skeuomorphism comes up anyway, how do we find metal based on ceramics where no parallel pieces survive? The answer is from metal shapes and workmanship in terracotta. Fluting, engraving, divisions of shape, decoration, solid handles versus hollow feet, and fake rivet heads. Not all of these features are necessary for a pot, but preserve, the argument goes, the original in metal transferred to a terracotta object, generally vases. I think, and there's enormous disagreement about this among scholars, that the characteristic Etruscan terracotta vessels called bucaro, with their shiny black surfaces, were designed as a cheaper substitute for silver vessels. Many pieces in bucaro have, in addition to their shapes and the shiny metallic glaze, features such as flutes and ribbing and rivet heads that make sense only in a metal vessel, not a terracotta one. A superb example of Etruscan skeuomorphism is a 6th century BC terracotta storage jar, a adolium. It has a stout, flaring rim, a body composed of vertical, slightly diagonal flutes, and is ornamented with three registers of decoration. Just above the plain lower body is a horizontal band of applied clay decoration of a raised, undulating pattern. The main upper body of the vessel is defined by the series of flutes and ridges. This is surmounted by the main decorative feature, a horizontal register formed by 15 small rectangular plaques with stamped designs. 14 of these plaques contain a horseman in profile, facing right, with a bird in the field above and behind him. The 15th plaque is a striding sphinx stamped sideways so that it faces up. There wasn't room for a 15th horseman plaque, so the sideways sphinx was substituted sideways and stamped last. Clearly, that problem of shoddy stuff made right before the weekend is not an exclusively modern one. Well, above the figural register is a second band of undulating clay. The form of the jar and its decoration rely on models from metalware vessels. The vertical ribs reproduce the form of a metal vessel, for which repoussé fluting provides the necessary ridges to stiffen the walls of the jar, reinforcing them. The decoration on the shoulder, like many of these jars, is created with multiple impressions of a flat seal, creating a series of rectangular scenes rather than a continuous frieze. The square ornamentation along the shoulder reproduces the effect of cast metal relief plaques found on large bronze vessels of the late Iron Age. Those plaques were applied to the large metal vessels, adding relief decoration, that is, figurative, floral, or geometric patterns. Well, so far, I've discussed several examples from the Etruscan craft industry, but not every industrial facility produced material that traveled or was available for sale in cities. The example of the Etruscan sanctuary at Cetamura del Chianti, a hilltop in the Chianti district of Tuscany, is instructive and offers a fascinating look into a facet of industry that's not often considered. That is, industries dedicated to supporting religious observance. The site, discovered in 2006, is a rural sanctuary about 18 miles north of Siena. The excavators cleared an Etruscan well there that was 100 Etruscan feet, or that's about 88 modern feet, deep. And it had been filled in over a period of 400 years, beginning in the 3rd century BC. Some of the material discovered in the well was deliberately deposited, though some ancient Etruscans also inadvertently dropped their bucket into the well from time to time. Altogether, 14 bronze vessels were recovered, along with hundreds of other objects, mostly in ceramic or metal. These demonstrate the ritual usage of the well and the range of industries at the site. In addition to the evidence of ritual activity this gives us, it also provides unique proof that ceramic and metalworking industries were located in the sanctuary itself and probably grew up there to supply those who visited it with the necessary materials for worship. Many of the hundreds of objects found in the well were clearly ritual in nature, including hundreds of miniature terracotta vessels that were substituted for the full-size ones in sacrifice. That said, full-size ceramic items, many with initials scratched on them, were also recovered. I think the situation is analogous to the founding of the California wine industry in 1683 to provide sacramental wine, or to the growth of beekeeping in the New World to ensure a sufficient supply of beeswax, which was mandated for the candles in Catholic services. Also recovered at Cetamura del Chianti were ceramic weights taken from vertical looms. This suggests women's dedications, as textile manufacture was women's work in the ancient world. Many bronze and iron amulets, utensils, rings, and unrecognizable objects were found as well. All of these were made on site on a lower terrace of the sanctuary that's been excavated, where a kiln and forge were found, definitive evidence, along with the waste products, that the industrial area was within the sanctuary. Religious officials, or far more likely, visiting pilgrims, would purchase these to sacrifice in the sanctuary as the culminating event of a visit. Along with the material from pilgrims, slag and ceramic wasters were found, indicating that those working in the local industries made their own dedications in the well. The sanctuary was dedicated to two underworld deities, Lur and Lenth, which explains the use of the well as a depository for such offerings. That might not explain the deposit of slag and wasters, however. These might be offerings such as the first fruits of a harvest or the first pour from a cup of wine as a gift to the gods. I think so. If true, that shows us the integration of these industries of clay and metalwork not only into the Etruscan economy, but into their religious structures as well. Well, I always ask my students, once they've written something, to stop and ask themselves, so what? By which I mean, what's the contribution here? Well, in the interest of modeling good practice, I should say that the contribution here is that even this short survey of the bronze and terracotta industries reveals the source of Etruscan wealth, their greatest artistic achievements, and industries whose products were integrated into virtually every facet of Etruscan life, from the home to the tomb and temple.